Please, speak as you might to a young child or a golden retriever.
It's an unfair game.
They're schemers. Schemers trying to control their little worlds.
Rich get richer, that's the law of the land.
It's just money.
Blasphemy! This is madness!
I drink your milkshake!
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Milkshakes, Markets, Madness. My name is John Kutzmita. I'm joined here with Brent Johnson, the man behind the Dollar Milkshake Theory. We welcome everyone back who is a regular viewer and listener. And if you are new to the show, you can learn more about Brent, the Dollar Milkshake Theory, and how the global financial system works on our YouTube channel, diving into the playlist at the top that says Start Here. And you also notice on our YouTube channel, everything is broken into segments with unique thumbnails. So if there's a specific type of video that you really enjoy, it's easy for you to find that and go down that rabbit hole. So Brent and I are about to record here with you the full-length episode. That's the end of the week video where we go a little longer than some of the others. And it's been quite a week, Brent, and really probably the most pertinent topic to start with. This video will be shared on Sunday, so who knows what type of last-minute decision will be made, but let's get your thoughts and put some attention on the government shutdown.
Well, you know, it's just one of these things where it seems like this happens all the time, and, you know, it always goes down to the last second, and, you know, a lot of times there's this Hail Mary at the very end, and, you know, they pass it. And essentially the reason they pass it is because both sides want to spend money. It's just a matter of where they want it to go, and, you know, they want to look like the winner when they finally do pass whatever they pass. There has been several times, though, where it actually does get shut down, and, you know, government workers don't go to work, and they get furloughed. And it's interesting, I actually know some people who, I just saw them on Friday. One of them is a marine biologist that works for the government. Another one's a lawyer that works for the government. And they were saying, yeah, we're getting furloughed on Monday. And what's kind of interesting is they just don't work. And it's part of the reason they don't work is there's nothing to do because the government shut down. But then the other thing is they don't get paid either because there is no government employee to actually push the button to pay them if there is a government shutdown. And so on the one hand, they were kind of saying, you know, it'd be nice to have a couple of days off. But on the other hand, you know, it sucks if you don't get paid. And so that was kind of interesting. And the other thing is that if you look back historically, when the government has been shut down, typically the stock market does pretty well. I don't know if that's just because the government's not there to screw things up or what, but I thought that's kind of an interesting thing. And now I saw recently that it sounds like today, I don't know if you saw this or not, they were working towards a last minute, you know, funding bill. And the one of the congressmen from New York, the Republicans were trying to get it passed. The Democrats wanted to hold it up. And so kind of at the last minute, it's so funny. The Democrat congressman from New York went and pulled a fire alarm. And oh, so it got delayed. So it got delayed, right? And so, and then of course it comes out, oh, you know, I didn't mean to pull it. It was an accident, but they have him on film doing it. I mean, it's just so perfect. It's just so par for the course with what's going on in the world right now. So I'm not sure. It sounds to me like they're actually going to pass something later tonight, but whether or not they end up doing it or not, we'll see. But to me, you know, it's the market impact that a shutdown could have more than anything, though, is that a lot of the government, I don't know, figures that get calculated that impact the market don't get released on time if the government shut down. So you wouldn't get the non-farm payrolls number, you wouldn't get the CPI print for the previous month, and a lot of other, you know, government calculated data just doesn't come out. And I think that's kind of interesting because, you know, again, with as hawkish as Powell was a couple of weeks ago, data dependent, the data becomes more important, right? And so, you know, maybe if everything was going well in the world and the economy was humming along and they had a government shutdown over a couple things and the data wasn't that important, maybe it wouldn't be that big a deal. But just with everything else going on, I think it's just one more, you know, fly in the ointment that could cause a little volatility.
So we have we have a segment that we do called the Madness Edition. I feel like someone in Congress pulling a fire alarm when they're trying to figure out the fiscal budget is a topic that we'll save for that segment. You yep. also mentioned, you know, you kind of gave this anecdote about the government workers being furloughed and not getting paid. And also with that, some of the government data that may or may not be released. And so we also do a segment called Peak of the Week, where we look at these various things that are coming up on the economic calendar. And we won't get into it here, but we do have jobless claims coming out this week. And as you mentioned, the non-farm payroll. So tune in with us for that on Monday. We'll get a little deeper into those topics. But what is interesting is kind of how the Fed tries to tackle this. Let's presume that a resolution isn't made come Monday. And we go into a week where volatility, you know, kicks up. How do you think in that type of situation, maybe this is forecasting too far, but what kind of impact do you think that that does have on a Fed policy decision?
If the data doesn't get released, or if it comes, sorry, I misunderstood what you said there.
I'm just saying if we're going into a week where the government does go into a shutdown, you know, are they taking that into consideration? Because one of the things we talk about often when it comes to Fed policy, economic data, is the lag effect. I mean, whatever happens with a government shutdown isn't going to suddenly show up in the economy 2 days later.
Yeah, you know, it brings up a good question. I actually don't know the answer to this. I don't know if the Fed shuts down. I need to look that up. I don't think they do, but maybe they do. But I guess my point is they have all their own staff that does all these calculations. So they have somebody that's tracking unemployment, and they have somebody that's tracking, you know, inflation internally. But then they ultimately rely on what the other parts of the government are doing as well, right? And they probably compare the two. So my guess was that it wouldn't necessarily impact the Fed itself, but it might dramatically affect all the market participants who are they don't have these in-house people doing all these calculations. And they're relying on the publicly released government statistics. So, you know, if the government stayed shut down for a month and we didn't have any data come out over the next month, and then we get into the Fed meeting at the, you know, on October 31st or whenever it is. Also, and that's kind of interesting, right? I think the Fed meeting's on Halloween this year. You have to look that up too. So yeah, I guess that's kind of my point with all of this is that I don't know what happens. It's hard to make a decision if you don't have the data on which to make the decision. If the government stays open and all the data that comes out this month is hawkish, I would expect them then to, you know, hike rates come October 31st. But if all the data comes out and it's all dovish, then it makes it much more, you know, up in the air, right? Questionable whether or not they're going to raise rates or not. So I just think it's interesting that we're at this point where everybody's waiting for the change in monetary policy. It's become more data dependent than any time that I can remember, and now the data might not even be released to us. You know, again, it's just kind of par for the course with all the craziness that's going on.
Well, you have said for some time that, you know, we're coming out of the summer doldrums and going into the fall, which tends to be a volatile time of year. This is certainly adding a spark to that. You know, the Federal Reserve being a private entity, I would imagine that what the government shutdown would impact potentially probably would be my guess not impact them directly as far as whether they're going to operate or not. But if it did, I'm sure a lot of people would be cheering on government shutdowns more frequently. But with volatility in mind, hawkish data somewhat in mind, and everyone trying to figure out where things are going here in this last quarter, which we're about to enter, you did make a comment very early on that kind of stuck with me before I introduced this next set of questions or data, and that you made a point about how the stock market or risk assets perform during a government shutdown. They usually do well. It was kind of ironic and initially overlooked by a lot of people that when the Fed goes through a rate hiking cycle, the market tends to go up. It does feel like really, I mean, maybe this is super lazy investing. Generally, the major indexes continue to perform, and it's more these sudden shocks of volatility or black swan events that kind of, you know, knock things off course. But with that in mind, we are going into now the season of volatility, like I just mentioned, and you've been highlighting for some time. The S&P just had its largest quarterly decline in a year, so maybe the trend is finally starting to shift. And there's been a handful of stocks that hit 52-week lows this week. Disney, Target, Pfizer, UPS, General yep. Mills, Kellogg. I mean, there's a big list. So, you know, and with that question kind of being framed, I also want to highlight the fact that as much as you know, make these various types of analogies and you engage people in a certain way on Twitter, your portfolio is generally long. You're hedged a certain way. So that's why I kind of stack all this up, because it's the S&P and the indexes over time just continue to perform, but you want to have defense in case we have some of these shocks or volatile or black swan moments. Do you think this is kind of just a temporary pullback that you've been saying for a long time needed to happen? Or is this maybe the early signals of something worse? And do you think this is hawkish enough to keep the Fed from hiking again in October?
Well, no, I think, so a couple of things there. We have had a pullback here, but I'm going to put my glasses on here to make sure I'm reading this correctly. I'm just going to give you a quick little synopsis of where we're at year to date. So as of the close of business on Friday, the NASDAQ's up about 34% for the year. The S&P's up about 11%. The Russell 2000 is only up 1%. So the really broad one is only up 1%. The Dow is only up 1% for the year. So the big blue chips haven't really done much this year. Gold is up 1% for the year. Silver is down 8% for the year. The 10-year bond is down 4% for the year, and the long bond is down 10% for the year, and oil is up 13% for the year. So, but that's year to date. If we go back to the middle of June, and the reason I'm going to highlight the middle of June is because if you remember, that's when I said I was basically net short. Since June 15th, oil is up 28%. So that's made a huge move since June 15th. The Dow is down Dow's down 3% since then. The S&P's down 4%. The Russell's down 5.5%. The NASDAQ's down 4%. Gold is down 6%. Silver's down 8%. 10 years down 5%. 30 years down 10%. So the reason I reference that is that in kind of mid to late June, you know, I said that I thought I was always long, but that was typically had some hedges in place. But you know, as of kind of the third week in June, I had enough puts that I thought I was basically net short, right? And so initially that went higher into July, but since then it's pulled back down, and now those markets are, other than with the exception of the oil market, all those markets are down. But they're not down significantly, right? I said, you know, they're down between 3% and 5%. They're down between probably 7% to 8% since the mid-July, but since mid-June, they're down whatever it was, 3% to 5%. So that's kind of the start of a correction. I still think that we are going to have more of a correction. I think that's not the correction I've been looking for, because we're not that far below where we were in June. But I'm still not in the camp that we're going to have a 40% drawdown and we're going to stay down for 4 years and we're going to have the worst bear market in history. I think we could easily have a 20 or 30% drawdown, but I think it would most likely be responded to in some form that would then send the market higher. Again, I'd have to kind of wait and see how they react when that happens, but I do not expect equities to fall and for us to stay in this, you know, depression for a long, long time, at least not in the US. But we'll have to wait and see. So that's kind of where we're at. I do think that now we're kind of in this time period where I think everybody was expecting the Fed to kind of roll over and rate hikes would be over and it wouldn't be long before the rate cuts started. That's kind of been pushed off. It's been pushed way off into, you know, late 2024 or even 2025. You know, if we have some kind of a disaster between now and then, of course the Fed will turn sooner if they have to, but I think this is what the Fed wants. I think they want to be higher for longer. I think they want to slow the economy. And I think that they think that equity prices and in general risk assets will come down as they slow the economy. So I don't think this, if I was Powell and I was trying to do what he's doing, I wouldn't look at what's going on now and say, this is really out of bounds. It seems pretty much in line with what he's been saying he wants to do.
So oil having this kind of turnaround the second half of the year has really perked up the, let's call them the energy bulls. Uranium's yep. kind of doing a thing now, but oil is more of a crowd favorite. And this is another one of those things where it's the new super cycle in energy. But it also is very indicative of oil prior to recession. And certainly if it's not, if oil is not an indicator of any kind, looking at everything else that's going on, and potentially it's a sign of the correction you've been waiting for, that just hasn't happened yet. If we do go into a recession, whether it's a shallow one, a short one, or a deeper one, you know, do you feel like some of that enthusiasm around energy and oil is conveniently ignoring what oil and energy typically does in a recession?
Sort of, yes. And so, but this sort of gets into short-term versus kind of medium to long-term. I think we've talked about this a little bit. I'm actually short some oil right now, not because I'm an oil bear, but just I think it came a long way in a very short period of time. And I think it the rise in oil coincided with the time where equities were starting to top out and roll over. And so over the last month or so, as we've discussed, equities kind of have topped out and they've started to roll over now. By no means is this like a dramatic drawdown in equity so far, but you're starting to see it, right? And you're starting to see some of the belief that the rate cuts were going to become immediately start to go to the wayside. And as we stay higher for longer, you're going to have this natural tightening. And so I think you could see, you know, this further decrease in risk assets, as I've been discussing. And I think when that initially happens, that's probably bad for oil, right? It doesn't mean that oil is going to crash and stay down forever, but I could just see it going back to $80 or whatever it is. You know, it got as high as 94, 95 a week or so ago. That's a long way. Like I said, it's up 30% in a month and a half or 2 months, right? And that's a big move. I mean, when commodities move 30% in a month or so, it's, you know, that's the space that it can happen. You know, it's easier for commodities to move 20 or 30% in a month than it is for equities. But when they have these big runs, they typically have these big pullbacks as well. And so I just think we're probably due for a little bit of a pullback in oil. And part of it is, I think, that the economy is slowing. And if there does start to be some of these recession fears and the fears that and coinciding with the understanding that maybe the Fed is not going to bail the market out as quickly as they have in the past, then I think you could see oil pull back. But it's not going to change the fact that the further we get into winter, the further, you know, things are, you know, energy is going to be needed to heat the world, and I think the further we go along, we're going to have more geopolitical, you know, chaos, for lack of a better way of saying it, and you could have supply constraints, and they've drawn down the strategic petroleum reserve a lot. We've talked about that. I've talked about how I think it worked as it was supposed to work, but they've drawn it down now. They don't have as big a cushion as they used to. And so, you know, when you put all these things together, it's a potential supply chain disruptions, so a potential geopolitical conflicts, potential increased demand due to a cold winter, all this different kind of stuff, you could easily get a short squeeze in oil where, you know, oil jumps back to 100 and $120. And if that happens at the same time that a slowdown is happening in the economy, that's a double whammy, right? Not only that, but here's This kind of brings back shades of a year ago. So remember where we were a year ago? A year ago, the dollar was at, you know, 110 to 114 at this time frame. Now it's at 106. So it had a big pullback, but now it's starting to rally again. It's rallied for 11 or 12 weeks in a row now. So if you are not in the U.S., and I know everybody says, oh, the dollar is only up versus other currencies. It's not strong versus anything else. Okay, fine. Well, imagine you're not American, right? Imagine you live in Europe where the euro's down. Imagine you live in Japan where the yen is down. Imagine you live in China where the yuan is down. But you still have to buy oil and you have to buy it in dollars. So, you know, not only is your currency worth less than it was versus the dollar a year ago or whatever it is, or from 6 months ago or 9 months ago. But now oil is higher again too. So you're getting double whammy. So this is where you get, this is the worst of all worlds for the rest of the world, because you get inflation. The rest of the world gets inflation in their local currency terms, because commodities, which trade in dollars, are getting short squeezed, and they trade in dollars. So your input costs to run your economy are higher, but you're also, the global economy is slowing, right? So your revenues are falling, and the financing costs for just about everything takes place in dollars, and the dollar is higher. Not only is the dollar higher, but the interest rates on the dollar are higher. So you have a higher dollar, you have higher rates, you have higher input costs, and you have a slowing economy. That's pretty bad, right? I mean, at least that's not great. And that's the situation that the rest of the world is. It's not like the U.S. is in a great place either. It's just that at the end of the day, we can print dollars. If we have to, we can print them. The rest of the world can't print them. And so it's not that it won't hurt the U.S. This would hurt the U.S. as well. I just think it's going to have a bigger outsized impact on the rest of the world than it is here at home. And the other thing that's changed a lot in the last several decades is that the U.S. used to be an oil importer. 25, 30 years ago, oil at 110 or 120 would be a much bigger deal than it is now. I'm not saying it's not a big deal now. It still is. But it would have been a much bigger deal, back in the 80s than it is now, because we're such a large energy producer now.
Yeah, having this conversation, one of the things, you did use the term input costs, which is really what keeps running around in my head as we're talking here, because energy, the cost of it, oil specifically, is a big input cost, right? And that potentially creates inflation in other places. I think that's one of the reasons why the price of oil going up has put some pressure on the bond market, and has certainly added fuel to the fact that the Fed might be already leaning more towards a hike at the end of October. The other input costs in other aspects of all kinds of business, especially when businesses try to finance themselves, commercial real estate's probably the easiest example, but all businesses have to go into the bond markets to finance themselves. So the cost of credit, being up exceptionally higher than where it was just a year ago, plays a big role. It's a big input cost. But you also bring back this, bring it back to the core of the most expensive input cost for everyone around the world, and that is the dollar. You've shared this point in other interviews you've done. We've talked about it here, where when you're looking at the price of things, or you're looking on, say, a Bloomberg screen, the dollar or the price of the dollar is just a straight line across the board, because everything kind of evolves around that, except if you're in another marketplace where you have to go and acquire dollars to participate in on the global stage. So with that in mind, as you highlighted, the dollar's kind of been on a tear. And at the same time, you're seeing bond prices decline, which really is the inverse of what interest rates are doing, which is interest rates are going up, only adding further fuel to that. Something you've said extensively is that it's overseas where you're going to start to see things break first. So do you want to pick that baton back up? Because I know we all know you love talking about the dollar and rubbing it in everyone's face when it has a moment like this. Not because you love the dollar, but because I think you oftentimes reinforce the fact that the dollar milkshake and the conversations we're having are to try to cool people down with some of the narratives they're reaching for to justify their positions or ideologies. And so when all of that gets thrown back in their face and they have to, or at least should be reevaluating those narratives and those views, it kind of gives you a smirk. So let's talk a little bit more about the price of bonds and how this is influencing the strength of the dollar and where this is already starting to show up in overseas markets.
Sure. So I think the best way to address this is to talk about, I think many times when people hear me talk about the dominance of the dollar or the fact that the U.S. is still the strongest country in the world, I think they automatically assume that that also means that treasury prices can't fall. U.S. treasury prices can't fall. But that is simply not the case. And for my theory to play out, and whether it will or not, you know, we'll see. But I don't need U.S. treasury prices to rise for my theory to play out. To be honest, in either scenario, in a highly inflationary scenario where interest rates rise, that's actually pretty good for the dollar milkshake theory. Or in a scenario where we get a massive deflationary event and everybody rushes to the safety of U.S. Treasury, or at least the perceived safety of U.S. Treasuries, and the price of Treasuries rises a lot and the yields fall a lot, that would probably be good for the dollar. But under both of those situations, it's good for the dollar. And it would really only be a return to normal and a Goldilocks scenario where we have kind of synchronized global growth that would be bad for the dollar. Because under either of the other scenarios, it's good for the dollar. And here's the reason why. Is as bond prices fall, and listen, U.S. Treasury prices are down like 30 to 35% over the last, you know, 1.5 to 2 years. That's a huge drawdown. But it's not a huge drawdown when you consider what the Fed has done with interest rates. You know, we talked about this last week or 2 weeks ago, and we compared it to previous rate hiking cycles. And what's happened with the U.S. Treasury is very much in line with what happened in previous rate hiking cycles. So this is not a big shock to anybody who understands bond math. But the reason that as bond prices has fallen, that the U.S. dollar has pretty much gone up in correlation with it, is because everybody needs dollars to operate on the global stage already. We've discussed this many times. Again, and it doesn't matter if you think it should or not, it's just the way it is. And if you already have to own a certain currency to operate on the global stage, and now you also get paid a lot more to hold that currency than you get paid to hold a competing currency, it makes the decision even easier than it was before. So in other words, when big global allocators or when big global dollar receivers receive those dollars and they need to save them in order to buy oil or buy other import costs or trade on the global stage, they save them in the form of U.S. Treasury bonds. Now, they may decide to hold those in short-term T-bills. They may decide to hold them in U.S. agency bonds. They may buy the 10-year bond or they might buy the long bond. You know, it all kind of depends on what exactly it is they're trying to accomplish and over what time period they want to hold those savings. But that is the form in which they hold their savings. Now, again, you might think that they shouldn't. I'm just telling you that's what they do, whether you think they should or not. So as a result, when somebody has these dollars and they have the choice of, and they know they're going to need dollars in the future, they have the choice to hold the dollar and get paid 4.5%. Or sell the dollar, go buy another currency that may fall versus the dollar, and then buy a bond in that currency that's paying less than the U.S. bond, right? So the point is as the U.S. dollar gets stronger and people want to hold it, they don't want to hold their own currency, which is falling versus the dollar, and they want to put it into something, then they don't just leave it in cash, then the fact that the interest rates are going higher in the U.S. makes it even more attractive. In other words, it makes the bonds even more attractive when they're cheap than when they're expensive. It's like if you're out buying a Ferrari, you know, and you see two Ferraris that are the exact same. One of them costs $100,000 and the other one costs $200,000. You're going to buy the one that costs $100,000 because it's cheaper, right? And so it's kind of the same thing. You get paid more, or you know, if you're buying two stocks, they do the exact same thing. They have the exact same growth potential. But one pays a 5% dividend and one pays a 0% dividend, you're going to pay or if you're putting your money in a bank and you're going to go store your money and you're going to put it in a savings account, do you want to put it in a savings account that's paying 5% or do you want to put it in a savings account that's paying 1%? So again, that's why lower bond prices actually are a benefit to the strength of the dollar. It's a interest rate parity or is a way to think about it. You know, all things being equal, the bond with the higher interest rate is going to be more attractive. And so but in order to buy treasury bonds, you have to buy dollars. So you either have dollars and you're buying bonds, or you have to buy the dollars in order to buy the bonds. So it's just that is why lower bond prices are actually a strength for the U.S. dollar. And this is, and going back to the milkshake theory as a whole, is that, I want to be absolutely clear about this, is this theory does not say the U.S. will not get hurt. The U.S. will absolutely get hurt in this theory. Everybody, in a global crisis, nobody comes out totally unscathed. So everybody's going to get hit. And so it's not a question of who gets hit first. It's not a question of who gets hit the hardest. It's really a question of who survives longest, despite taking all the hits. So it's really about who's the last person standing. And I just believe that out of all the countries, the U.S. will be the last country standing for a number of reasons that we've discussed many times. So the fact that U.S. Treasury rates are going higher and we have to spend more to fund the government, to me, does it hurt? Yeah, it hurts a little bit, but it doesn't hurt us as bad as it hurts the rest of the world.
Yeah, I mean, the dollar milkshake theory, using these different movies to visualize the idea overall, was an excellent approach to it. I'm just surprised now that you're talking about it in the context of, given how much confusion often comes with people's interpretation of what you're saying, I'm surprised you didn't, you know, add Rocky in there as the last man standing. Because everybody, you know what's funny?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know what's funny is when I kind of first started talking about it was back in 2018, and the Fed was first starting to raise rates after years of having them low, but rates were still very low. So nobody really gave a lot of thought to higher rates because they just weren't a reality at the time. But now, 4 years later, when rates are not at 1% they're not at 50 basis points going to 75 basis points, right? They were at 1.5% a year and a half ago. Now they're at 4.5% or 5%, depending on, you know, which bond you're looking at or which rate you're looking at. So now you're back to a real interest rate, and now it's very visible. And so it's funny to me when people, back when I first started talking about this, people would say, well, the rates aren't that high and the U.S. isn't going to raise them very high, so it's not going to work. And now the rates are higher, which is kind of where I said they would end up being. They're like, well, it's not working because bond prices are falling. Well, okay. You can't have higher rates and higher bonds. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah, classic. Your basic understanding of bonds, you know, should be researched before battling that part of it. But the other thing too here is worth talking about is, how do I set this up for you? You have, when you need to acquire, like, maybe in your wallet, you've got $20, $100, whatever. You're not carrying around a lot of cash. But if you're a government, a sovereign nation, and you need to be able to play on the global stage and you need dollars, you're not walking around with, you know, a shipping container full of dollar bills. The way that you're storing that liquidity and that collateral, or that liquidity is through the treasury bonds as the collateral. But what's really interesting, we kind of did a flyby on this at one point, but we didn't necessarily go as deep as I think maybe we should and we've even wanted to, is that if you are, let's take China, for example, a nation that's for some time hedged its need for dollar liquidity with, you know, holding a large supply of treasury bonds that you purchased over the last decade at relatively much higher prices than where bonds are at now. For you to sell those bonds into the market to get the dollar liquidity that you need, you're actually taking a big haircut. And I don't think there's enough credit given to the kind of weaponization of Fed policy unintentionally and intentionally when you consider those types of dynamics and mathematics.
Yeah, and see, this is the argument that I have. Part of the reason that I've pounded the table on the dollar as hard as I have is not because I think it's a good system, but because I think the system is dramatically misunderstood. And I think there's an element to it that even those that understand it just don't want to admit that's real. And that is that the fact that the U.S. can literally use it as a weapon. And what makes it even harder to accept is there's a duality to it. And what I mean by that is the U.S. can't just out of the blue, if we were in a depressionary state, we could not hike interest rates to 5%, right? But the fact that we're in a little bit better shape than everybody else allows us to do it. And so when we're hiking rates, we're able to do it. And because we have high inflation, we're able to do it under the guise of U.S. domestic monetary policy. Listen, we're just taking care of our own domestic economy, which is what our mandate is, okay? Well, that's absolutely true. But perhaps they could have gone slower. Perhaps they didn't have to go from 1.5 or was it 0.50 basis points on the federal funds rate to 5.5% in 18 months. Perhaps they could have done it over 2 or 3 years, or perhaps they could have gone from, 50 basis points to 350 basis points. But the fact that they can do, when they do this, the fact that it hurts the rest of the world, it's almost like a stealth weapon, right? And who's to say that the last 200 basis points of hikes were purely for domestic purposes? Maybe the first 250 basis points were for domestic purposes, and maybe the second 250 basis points were kind of a stick in the eye to the rest of the world, you know? And thing is it can't be proved. And many people will say, oh, you're ascribing malice to something that's really being done for the altruistic reasons domestically. Well, maybe. But what I know for sure is that in 1993, I think federal funds rate were at like 3%. And by 1999, federal funds rate were around 6%. And in that intervening 7 years, we had the Mexican bond crisis, we had the Asian currency crisis, and we had the Russian debt default. So, is it totally coincidental? Maybe. Maybe not, right? And even if it is 100% coincidental, it doesn't mean that it can't be used offensively. So this is, it's monetary policy is basically a defensive mechanism to protect the domestic economy. But, a very good defense can be used offensively. Deion Sanders is a perfect example. He was a defensive back, but he scored a lot of touchdowns. And he hurt the other team quite a bit. And I think anybody who had him on his team would say he's our best weapon, right? If there wasn't this duality to it, it would be much more obvious that it was being done. And the blowback would be much more severe. But the fact that there is this stealth kind of duality to it where it's not quite clear why it's being used, it makes it that much more effective and it makes it that much easier to defend for the U.S. to defend its position. And so, I've kind of gotten to the point where I don't care whether people see this or not. I want them to see it. And the reason I've pounded the table on it is because I want to help them, but I can't make people believe, right? But I'm telling you, it's possible to be used this way. Maybe it's never been used this way before. Maybe it never will be, but it's possible. And I think that as we move forward in this, geopolitical Game of Thrones that we've talked about, I think every option and every weapon is on the table. And I think it is being used and I think it will be used again. And I think it's very important to understand that it can be used this way. And so for anybody who's not familiar with what we're talking about, the fact that the U.S., if everybody is holding, this is what John was referring to. If somebody puts let's say you have $1 million and you put that in treasury bonds and that's your savings account for a rainy day. And you did that when interest rates were 1%. And then now all of a sudden the Fed has hiked rates dramatically in the United States and now interest rates are 5%. And in that time frame, the 10-year bond that you bought originally was yielding 1% and now it's yielding 4.5%. That means that the bonds that you owned are down dramatically. So you're $1 million is now worth, $800,000. And now things are tight out there. You have to tap your savings account, right? Well, the U.S. is saying, okay, yeah, go tap your savings account, but there's an early withdrawal penalty. If you hold it to maturity, we'll give you all the money that you put in. But if you don't, if you pull it out early, there's a withdrawal penalty. And the withdrawal penalty is pretty stiff. It's 20% or whatever the number is. And so that it's kind of this very ingenious system, for lack of a better way of saying it. It's just, it is the way it is now. And some people will say, well, it wasn't designed for this. It's just so it's a coincidence. And again, listen, I don't care whether it was designed specifically for it or if it's a coincidence. The fact that it exists is a fact, and it can be used as such. And so as people and institutions and, you know, entities around the world get into these economic crises, typically when their revenues are down as well and they have to tap their savings accounts, they're tapping their savings accounts typically at a withdrawal penalty time period. And so that allow, and that fact kind of reinforces the relative strength of the United States versus that entity. And I just think it's very important to understand that dynamic.
Yeah, the stealth duality, I like that. We did an episode, I think now 2 weeks ago, called The Great Fall of China. And we were kind of highlighting as a core part of that conversation, some of the chart crimes that were going on around the specific amount of activity that was going on with China and China's bond holdings. And the picture that people were trying to paint was, oh, look, China is dumping bonds, when the reality was the net asset value of China's bond portfolio was rapidly declining. So in essence, their purchasing power that they thought they had, you know, hedged away, had eroded at a time when they needed it most, because they're going through all kinds of issues in their domestic economy at the moment. So it's a nice correlation between that episode and kind of this stealth duality weaponization. But also to reinforce your point that it's kind of that Rocky analogy of, you know, Rocky might have lasted the whole fight, and maybe, you know, he even won in the later movies, but not without getting a bunch of black eyes. And so in this environment where the Fed is raising rates under, you know, maybe it is a guise to control inflation, maybe they're more aggressive than some might think they should be for geopolitical reasons. But as a result, you end up getting the pain that you've been discussing, but you also end up getting real yields. And when real yields start to reach the point that they're kind of at right now, which is this 2%, and they start to creep above that, it's not just, you know, the Mexican peso crisis and the Russian ruble crisis. You start to get you know, major economic events in the U.S. as well. So it is kind of a game of you know, Russian roulette to some extent.
Yeah, and think about this, John. Think about what happened 18 months ago now. So 18 months ago, you know, Russia invaded Ukraine. And in response to that, the United States and much of the other Western countries decided to kick Russia out of SWIFT and confiscated billions of dollars in Russian assets. And I don't remember the exact number. I think it was $500 or $600 billion of Russian assets, of Russian reserves. Literally money. They stole their money. They took their money, right? And that was hailed as a horrible decision on behalf of the U.S. And I tend to agree. That is probably, when we look back on it 10, 20, 30 years from now, I think that will be looked back on as an inflection point. And I think it will be reflected on as a mistake that the United States did this. That's my belief. Now, whether that comes to true, I don't know. But that, I think that that's probably the case. But the point is that when that, but since that happened, there has been a lot of blowback, for lack of a better way of saying it, from the global South, right? And not only from the global South, but other entities, analysts, investors in the West have said, holy cow, you know, that's a dumb move by the U.S. Now nobody or people will think twice before they buy treasury bonds or before they hold dollars, because if the U.S. can just take them from them, like a bully would just take it away, then, you know, we can't trust you anymore. Okay. And I agree that's kind of, that's kind of an in your face, very brutal way to take somebody else's reserves. But what if you took $500 billion in reserves just by raising interest rates? There's not the blowback because it's not obvious, right? So again, you know, think about, you know, I would bet there's been more than $500 billion have been lost in reserve accounts around the world as the result from interest rates going from 0% to 5.5% than there was by us just taking it from Russia. And so, you know, if people were to cash those reserves in now, they would lose more than Russia lost if they were to cash all those in. And so again, it's not exactly like confiscating somebody else's reserves, but it kind of is. It's putting a liquidity it's put in a liquidity, but a valuation, decrease on their portfolio. And if you're decreasing somebody's reserves, is it really that much different than stealing them? I mean, if we dropped rates, those reserves would go back up. And we could take the money that we took from Russia and give it back to them. I mean, other than how you categorize them, are they really that different? And so again, I know there's people out there listening to this and say, this is not the way bonds work. This is not why the Fed raises or lowers interest rates. And listen, I agree. That's not their primary reason. But I don't think that they're as stupid as everybody else thinks that they are. And I don't think that they're blind to the fact that they can do this. And the fact is they have done it. So anyway, that's my story and I'm sticking to it.
Yeah, you do kind of have this, kind of like a time decay impact. It's almost, we would definitely do not have time to go down this rabbit hole right now, but it's kind of like an international CBDC. It's like a central bank digital currency.
That's exactly what it is. That's what it is, John. This is the thing. I'm so glad you said that. The dollar is already digital. This is and it all flows through a central location. It flows through the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department, right? And they can say, boom, it's gone, just like that. Now, just like in a CBDC, if they said, boom, it's gone, there will be blowback. There will be people pissed off. Molotov cocktails will be thrown. Strikes will show up. Truckers will cross, shut down roads. But that doesn't mean that they can't do it. And, and that's kind of what they're doing. It's kind of what they did to Russia, right? And so, I think the real CBDC would just be an extension of what they're already doing.
Yeah, the difference here, going back to what we kicked off this conversation, is because of the volume of the holdings and the way that governments operate on the global stage, they're not holding cash, so to speak, right? They're holding the government bonds. Whereas Citizens United States or of other countries where a central bank would have a CBDC, the influence that the Federal Reserve has by raising rates and therefore devaluing the bonds that these entities are holding, in theory, a central bank digital currency would have that same power over money itself. Again, not something we're gonna dive into, but when you understand kind of the functional components, like you're saying, the dollar is already digitized. They do have this power to kind of create almost like a time decay on it. Is it a stealth duality? Is it just a knock-on effect that maybe they realized after the fact that it had this power? Those are mysteries that we don't know, and we're certainly not going to try to solve here on the show. But Brent, it's been a great conversation, a longer one than usual, but I think there are some important things that we tried to dissect and get a little more specific with on this episode. And I'm glad we took most of the time to do that instead of pandering the government shutdown. But we will see what happens with that probably in the next 48 hours. I appreciate you joining us and sharing all your wisdom. I appreciate everyone else for joining us. If you want to learn more about Brent and his dollar milkshake theory, you can visit the YouTube channel, check out all our great playlists, or you can visit Brent on Twitter. His handle is SantiagoAUFund. You can visit me on Twitter at John Kutzmita. You can find this show on Twitter and at YouTube using the handle MilkshakesPod. And you're welcome to visit milkshakespod.com to get some more information there as well. Brent, thank you again. Any last words?
No, it's getting interesting heading into the fourth quarter here. The volatility's taken a little bit longer to show up than I thought, but I feel like it's kind of showing up here. And I'm just excited to see whether we get some volatility in the fourth quarter or if we have smooth sailing from here. You never know with the markets, but to me, it's things are getting interesting.
I understand that from a measurement standpoint, volatility has felt subdued, but for me, when I look back on 2023 so far, especially with all the conversations we've had, it's not like it's been a dull year. So if there's going to be a little more chaos around the corner in Q4, I'm sure it'll make for some great conversations here. Thanks everybody for joining us. We'll see you guys real soon. This show is provided for entertainment and informational purposes only. It should not be relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. Neither the hosts, guests, nor any funds they may manage intends to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies.